Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Belarus. With me to discuss the recent anti-government protests against Belarus's President Alexander Lukashenko is Stephen Sestanovich. Steve is a George F. Kennan Senior Fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council and a Professor of International Diplomacy at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. From 1997 to 2001, Steve was the U.S. Ambassador at Large for the former Soviet states. He has also worked on the staff of the National Security Council in the State Department's Policy Planning Office and on Capitol Hill. He is the author of the excellent book, Maximalist, America in the World from Truman to Obama. Steve, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure, Jim.
Steve, we're sitting down to record this podcast in advance of Labor Day weekend in the United States. I want to talk to you about the political protests that have been ongoing in Belarus. I will note that these protests tend to be much larger over the weekend, and so there's going to be a weekend between now and when this episode goes live. But I was kind of hoping you could just sort of set the scene for us and tell us a little bit about the state of play in Belarus, the nature of the protest, who's turning out, things like that.
Sure. These started right after the elections of August 9th, which were widely seen not only to be fraudulent, but kind of outrageously, unbelievably, absurdly fraudulent.
So you don't think he got 80% of the vote?
Yeah, it would surprise me a little.
Okay.
So hundreds of thousands of people turned out in the streets. This is a society that has had some activity in, you know, what we would call civil society, but not all that much political opposition with a real popular resonance. However, it just became clear that Lukashenko had made one of the two big mistakes that post-Soviet dictators often make, which is just letting the election fraud get out of control. And then he compounded it with a second mistake that dictators of this sort often make, which is brutality and impunity. And so arresting thousands of people, beating them up, only increased the size of the crowds. That was all in the immediate aftermath. I think it's worth noting what's changed since then, since a lot of players have had time to take stock. The marches have not subsided. They continue, as you say, to be big on the weekends, but they're also, you know, they go on in the course of the week. They're mostly met with less violence by the authorities. They've decided, you know, they don't want to be on TV beating up women. They don't want to be on TV beating up kids going to school, even if the kids going to school are taunting them and saying snarky things about President Lukashenko. The opposition leadership is now mostly out of Belarus, but it's more organized and has gotten a more international presence. Mrs. Tikhanovskaya, the quote-unquote defeated candidate, is going to be speaking to the UN Security Council tomorrow, of all things. So there's some reach in the opposition's message.
Steve, I want to hear a bit more about the opposition and what it's made up of and what its aims are. But first, could you tell us a little bit about what is now Lukashenko's 26 years running Belarus?
He was elected as a kind of populist candidate in 1994. His calling card was that he was the former director of a Soviet collective farm. He does not have, shall we say, the most sophisticated presentation, but he seemed like a man of the people and was able to stir people up in the early 90s when it seemed that all the post-Soviet economies were going down the tubes. And Belarus had a particularly tough time. Almost immediately, he began putting the opposition out of business, and that has gotten more and more acute since then. Every election since his first one has been found by international observers, if they were allowed, to be not free and fair. But the international community didn't pay a whole lot of attention to this because there wasn't all that much in the way of domestic activists. There was activism. there were leaders, particularly from within the elite, often from the foreign ministry, interestingly, who would challenge Lukashenko, but they didn't strike much of a chord with the public. And although there was some reason, perhaps, to think that Lukashenko would face more dissatisfaction this time around, what happened in the way of protests, I think, took him and the opposition by surprise.
Do we have a sense, Steve, as to why opposition to Lukashenko finally took root this time around? As you note, he's been running unfair elections for some time. Is there something that's changed either economically in Belarus? Is it the pandemic? Something else going on?
All of the above. The economy has not done well, and Lukashenko has been more dependent on Russian energy subsidies. His handling of the pandemic was kind of beyond ridiculous. He advised people that saunas and vodka would cure everything. So there was really no response to the coronavirus. He has had an effort to try to cast himself as a kind of nationalist, despite his dependence on Russian economic assistance. And so he's sort of fought with the Russians a little bit, but that has not given him much standing. In addition, and this is probably as important as any of the others, he arrested or disqualified or exiled all of the leading candidates who sought to oppose him. We know Mrs. Tikhanovskaya because her husband, who was a well-known blogger, was jailed, not allowed to run. The response to this was kind of interesting, though, because it was a union of women. Tikhanovsky, his wife Tikhanovskaya, was represented by her, the campaign manager of one of the other candidates, who was a woman, came forward, and together with another woman activist, they created a kind of trio of opposition figures to try to evoke hostility to Lukashenko and outrage that, you know, he was degrading the entire process. I would say that although there's every reason to believe Lukashenko did worse everywhere in Belarus than in the past, he was particularly vulnerable in Minsk. As we've seen in a lot of post-Soviet societies, the opposition tends to have its roots in the capital. That's where you tend to have the more educated, cosmopolitan, enlightened, connected, internet active population. And so that's where the big sentiment and the outrage about the fraud was strongest. You know, people could see that the fraud was taking place before their very eyes. And that's where, of course, the demonstrations have been centered, although there have been plenty of marches in other cities in Belarus.
So is this to some extent a rural-urban divide, or is that too simplistic?
Lukashenko's base has certainly been rural. As I said, he was a collective farm director, but he has also managed to take over the Belarusian state. And so he's had a lot of the elite kind of tolerating him. Disaffected, but still complicit and playing along because power tends to have that effect on ambitious people and complacent people in capitals until there's something going on in the streets. One of the interesting developments is the extent to which this episode has divided the Belarus elite. We don't really know the extent of that. It looks as though what you're seeing on the streets are the Belarus Minsk bourgeoisie. But we don't have a really good feel for this. I'm surprised by how few polls we've seen. We're relying a lot on the impressions derived from social media and from the extraordinary unanimity and power of the crowds in the street. It seems to be everybody, which made people think at first that the elite around Lukashenko had abandoned.
But to this point, we haven't seen any clear signs that the regime is split. We haven't seen evidence that the security forces are refusing to go into the streets. I mean, I take your point that they had this initial crackdown. They seem to have drawn that back. And I can't tell whether that's because they're confident that they have the situation under control so they don't need the force, or that they're worried on the opposite end that if they use the force, they end up upsetting the regime. So there seems to be a lack of clarity on that.
there is some lack of clarity. You know, some Russian commentators have said the Kremlin is pretty satisfied that they've got the security forces, the military, the police, more or less unified and under their de facto control, some people are even saying. So that part of the elite may not have broken, but it's still a little hard to say. For example, would you, if you were the commander of the police in Minsk, would you be confident that your officers on the beat would, even the OMON, the security thugs, would really stand with you if you asked them to shed blood? I think there's some uncertainty about that. We haven't seen it tested since the first few days. In those days, there were, you know, Belarusian policemen and military people defecting to the other side, tearing up their uniforms. It made for great videos. We don't know whether things have tightened up a little bit in the interim.
Just one last question on the opposition. It's pretty clear they're against Lukashenko. Do we have any sense that they have a positive agenda beyond that? Or is this really just a group that's focused on pushing him out of office, and then we're likely to see some fracturing down the road if they succeed?
Well, let me take it in two pieces. The opposition has tried to say that their goal is to get Lukashenko out and to have a new election and to have prisoners released from jail, because they think that's what unites them. They do not hide the fact that they come from different political camps. They have different programs for what might follow in the country after they had a new government. Svetlana Alexievich, the Belarusian Nobel Prize winner, has openly supported one of the other candidates. She thinks the banker who was kept from running was the right guy for Belarus. But that doesn't keep her from serving on Tikhanovskaya's coordinating council to oversee the transition.
Let's sort of shift gears and talk about a country that you've already dropped, and that's Russia. And I need you to explain things for me. Maybe you partly answered the question when you noted that, to some extent, Lukashenko has tried to sort of burnish his anti-Russian credentials. Because as the campaign was ongoing just before the election, my understanding was Belarus arrested, I think it was 33 Russian mercenaries that had supposedly come to upend the election process. In the wake of the election, they were all released. I think all of them went home, except for one who was also a Belarusian citizen. So can you sort of explain to us what Russia's role is in all of this?
Lukashenko, as I said, has been trying to do two things: get the benefits of Russian economic support, energy subsidies in particular, while still making himself seem like the man who stands up for Belarus's sovereignty, a nationalist opposition to the bullies of Moscow. And the Russians have found this extremely irritating. They regard Lukashenko as kind of a clown, but they also think, okay, we'll play along. We don't see any real opportunity to get anything better. We'd have to interfere too much. They have been critical, but this, you know, they've kept it within bounds. Now you've had almost a complete reversal, and Lukashenko is relying on the Russians as his ultimate source of support. When the staff of Belarus TV walked off the set and went on strike, it was the Russians who flew in television technicians and media specialists to take over. They have said they're creating a reserve force of police in case the situation gets out of control, as Putin says, if people start burning cars and homes. They've talked about their willingness to invoke the terms of the Collective Security Treaty Organization. And Lukashenko is no longer emphasizing that Belarus and Russia are two different countries. He's saying we have a common fatherland. And this is music to the Russians' ears, because they have, for more than 20 years, had on paper at least, the idea that there was a union state between Russia and Belarus, which has been mostly meaningless. But now the Russians see in Lukashenko's vulnerability an opportunity to make that more of a reality, to absorb the institutions of the Belarus state into their own, because of his, you know, lack of any popular base anymore.
I'm curious. I saw a report that Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that Putin will host Lukashenko in the next couple of weeks. And I take that as a signal of Moscow's support for Lukashenko. But I was wondering, you know, to what extent would Lukashenko be willing to leave Belarus? Because one of the problems is if you leave, things could change while you're away.
Yes, I think that's not the only source of uncertainty on Lukashenko's part as to whether the Russians are completely behind him. Sergei Lavrov said when he met with the Belarus foreign minister in Moscow, he said, you know, these constitutional changes, they need to go forward. We need to have the leadership of Belarus, the issue of the future leadership, depersonalized. Which sounds as though it's sort of saying, you know, it doesn't have to be Lukashenko. It could be somebody else. So Lukashenko's anxiety is that the Russians are just, you know, showing him the door in a graceful way. Would he have anxiety about flying out of Belarus to Moscow and back? I suspect he would do this if he were already pretty much under the control of the Russian air traffic controllers. the security situation would have really come under Russia's control. There are some Western analysts who, looking at pictures of Lukashenko in the past few days, have said that he seems to be in the presence of Russian bodyguards already. I can't confirm this, but it would fit with a general perception that I think is shared among Russians and Europeans as well, and surely people in Belarus, that the instruments of power are being slowly taken into Russian hands.
So I have to ask, you know, one of the reasons we talk about Russia is because Russia has a track record of intervening in other countries in its near abroad, which have seen popular uprisings overturning governments, most notably in Ukraine. So how is the prospect of, let's say, Ukraine being repeated influencing the opposition? Do we have some sense of that?
Well, we have some sense in the sense that both in Belarus and in Russia, the parallels to Ukraine are mentioned all the time. You know, an uprising in the streets, which becomes increasingly pro-Western. And that's an issue we need to come back to. But here's a big difference. In Georgia and in Ukraine, whatever the ultimate Russian goals were, they ended up satisfying themselves by taking a chunk of the country away. What is more ambitious, and in some ways for Western European and American policymakers, a sharper problem is the prospect of the entire country being absorbed by the Russians. You know, it is the watchword of the opposition in the streets in Belarus that Belarusian sovereignty needs to be preserved. That's what they're in favor of. That's as close as they get to saying, we don't want to be absorbed into Russia. It's also the watchword of American statements of EU policymakers. They say, we're interested in preserving Belarus' sovereignty. And one of the differences here is the Russians aren't nibbling at the border. They're at least looking at raising the prospect of taking the Belarusian state from within and making the Union state a reality. I think Western policymakers are having trouble with that, trying to figure out exactly how to orient themselves on the issue of sovereignty, partly because the Union state is on the books. It was signed up to by Boris Yeltsin, you know, our hero Democrat. But I heard an American official yesterday talk about this question of what the Union state is, and I think we'll probably hear more of this. He said, Lukashenko has lost the standing to move forward on this issue. The social contract between him and the Belarusian people, meaning his legitimacy, is over. So I think the US and Europe are going to say, if the Union state becomes the new reality, that is already a challenge and a defeat for the sovereignty of Belarus.
Let's talk a little bit about how the West has reacted. Maybe begin with the EU. EU foreign ministers met late last month. They approved a list of Belarusian government officials to be sanctioned because of their involvement in election fraud. Yeah. This seems to be more symbolic rather than a substantive act. But I take your point that the EU is a bit worried about provoking an outcome it doesn't want to have happen. Can you give us some sense of how the EU is trying to navigate that? Are there splits in the EU over how to approach it? Because, you know, obviously there are countries in the EU, particularly I think in Central Europe, that have been somewhat more sympathetic to Moscow, maybe to Belarus, others much more hostile. What's sort of the lineup there?
Well, here's the big issue here is, can you go beyond individual targeted sanctions, saying that bad guys in Belarus who have bank accounts in Berlin will never be able to draw on them? Or are you going to do something that involves a greater penalty for Belarus? And here's the problem. The Belarus opposition has said, we don't want sanctions that hurt Belarus, because they think that puts them in an awkward position, that it suggests that they've triggered moves that hurt their own countrymen.
And this goes back to your point that they don't want to be seen as being pro-Western or in league with countries in the West.
Yes. And so one of the issues, potential moves that could be taken by the West to sanction what's being done, at least off the table for the time being, as it applies to Belarus. You know, the EU has got its names. The United States, interestingly, already has a lot of those people sanctioned because we never removed our sanctions from 10, 12 years ago. And so there's some overlap between the people the US is targeting and Europe is targeting. There are other measures that are being considered. For example, the US, as part of courting Lukashenko and supporting him against Moscow, had made waivers to allow Belarus to make energy purchases from the West. The U.S. State Department says they're reviewing those questions as to whether those waivers should be made again in the future. You know, the big enchilada is, of course, whether you would go beyond sanctions against Belarus, and if something were done by the Russians that seemed especially offensive or problematic, whether you would take steps against Moscow. That will be a much bigger decision, and one that, in just the way that you describe, will divide the EU. For the EU, it's easy to say this or that person on the Belarus Election Commission is a criminal and will not be received in Paris. It's a much bigger step to go beyond that and contemplate measures against Moscow. But people are trying to convey that message. Steve Biegun, the Deputy Secretary of State, was in Moscow and trying to convey to the Russians, this is what State Department officials have said was their message, you think Russian-American relations are bad now. They are, but they can get a lot worse if you act in an irresponsible, dangerous, provocative way in Belarus.
Well, I'm glad you raised this broader context of U.S.-Russian relations, EU-Russian relations, because it seems to me that those tensions are very high and there are new provocations on that front, new tensions. We have the poisoning of Putin's critic, Alexei Navalny.
Yep.
Apparently now the Germans are saying it was Novichok, a nerve agent, was used to poison him. We've had an increasing number of incidents, or at least it seems to be an increasing number of incidents in recent weeks of Russian military forces harassing, coming close to NATO forces, non-aligned country forces like Sweden. We had a separate incident in Syria. So can you draw these all together for us? I mean, what are the big challenges here and how are they to be negotiated or navigated?
It's really easy to put all the elements of that together in just the way that you do. It's not the way the administration likes to sum up Russian-American relations. And here I'm not talking just about the weird Trump-Putin relationship. At the State Department, you will hear them say, and I believe this is what Biegun said to Lavrov recently, we've got elements of common interest, areas of cooperation where we want to go forward. So Biegun made a point in Moscow of a meeting with their senior North Korea negotiator to talk about measures on the North Korean nuclear issue. There have been recently meetings between the senior Russian and American arms negotiators to look at the question of whether or not you could renew the New START treaty. What the administration wants to do is warn that there are bad things ahead if Putin does the wrong thing, but also try to point to the positives. My guess is that that is going to seem interesting to the Russians. But Putin is, you know, if he is looking at the prospect of a major new step forward in reassembling the Soviet Union, which we know is in one form or another kind of on his mind.
Well, he considers the dissolution of the Soviet Union to have been what, the greatest geopolitical
tragedy. Yeah.
Yep.
He will think, I'm going to try to find a way to do this that doesn't drive everybody crazy, that shows there's a kind of legitimate basis inside Belarus for this new relationship that we have. And the West won't be able to object because we won't shed too much blood, won't crack open too many heads. We'll have a new election that, you know, maybe even somebody that was intended to be an opponent of Lukashenko can run in and win. The game for Putin here is to try to find a way to get his big geopolitical score without a major break with the West, worse than anything you've had so far, and bloodier than anything you've had so far. The problem for him is that it really looks as though this could end very violently. So, among the things one has to watch for here are whether the violence of the first few days after the election returns, whether you've got splits in the opposition, which has so far been pretty unified, that tempts the Russians to think, okay, we can crack down, maneuver, makes Lukashenko think he can stay in power. There are various elements of this situation as Putin envisions it that could easily spin out of control.
I want to ask you then, Steve, given how fluid the situation and how badly it could go, what is it that the administration should be doing right now? Is it doing everything it should be doing? Are there steps it hasn't taken that it should? And I ask that in the context of, I take your point that there are issues in which the United States wants Russian cooperation. But it seems to me that if you want to get something from the Russians, you're going to have to be willing to give something to the Russians. Simply saying it could get a lot worse probably isn't the most enticing proposal to put on the table. But I'm not sure here at home there's a lot of political support for offering anything to the Russians. So how do you, in putting on your diplomatic hat, bring all of those together into some sort of coherent policy?
I think the administration has had one issue right here, whatever the reasoning that led them to this position, and that is to try to downplay this as an issue of Russian-American confrontation. George Kent, who made himself a household name during the impeachment hearings, said yesterday that we don't want this to be anything that the Russians see as a geopolitical competition. They're entirely in favor of backing up the position that the Belarus opposition has taken, which is, this is all about Belarus's sovereignty. We're not looking to reorient ourselves. Tikhanovskaya has said, this is not a geopolitical revolution. It's a democratic revolution, and appealing to the Russians to see that there could be a democratic revolution that doesn't have geopolitical consequences. I think that's right. It's the obvious sound starting point. The real issue for the Russians is going to be how damaging they think the isolation they create for themselves is if they go forward and try to absorb Belarus. And here, I think it may be, I don't know what kinds of levers the West has, but they really ought to be, I think, emphasizing, at least in our own analyses right now, and even, I suppose, in talking to the Russians about this, that this is in some ways an even bigger deal than supporting a little insurgency in the east of Ukraine, which is, it's a kind of failed enterprise. But an attempt to kind of absorb an entire country that's right there on the the border between between Russia and the West is a big deal, a bigger geopolitical revolution than we've seen in some time. I don't know that there's anything that has been put on the table. One of the things that you will doubtless have in the backs of the Russians' minds as they think about this is, well, what are you prepared to tell us about, you say this shouldn't be a Russian-American issue of competition. Are you prepared to say Belarus should be neutral? if there were a case where you could say that Belarus itself would make that decision, I mean, where a country could make this decision, Belarus would be a good candidate because they obviously haven't yet come to see themselves as aligned with the West. There's not anti-Russian nationalism there. My view is you get nowhere trying to impose neutrality on countries. But if you could, you know, if it were a bottom-up thing, if the opposition were trying to say, we want permanently never to be aligned with, you know, with NATO, for example, we're not looking to join the EU, it might mean something to the Russians. But I think it has to go along with the kind of warning that you're hearing from American and European officials, which is there are also very bad consequences if you guys, you the Russians, proceed on the track that you seem to be on.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Steve Sestanovich, the George F. Kennan Senior Fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at CFR and the author of The Maximalist. Steve, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for the discussion.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe Collis was also a recording engineer. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.